That Topolsky Family Tree, North Tonawanda, New York. As recalled by Anthony J. Topolsky, Sr., and a few documents of vital statistics. My father, Michael Topolsky, was born in Poland. Date of birth, August 13, 1877, in the village of Unisova. Last post office in the town of Reglice, nearest city of Tarnów, county of Tarnów, regional section of Kraków, southern part of Poland, called Galicia or Małopolska. His parents were Joseph Topolsky and Mary Vitalis. His father was a weaver of linen cloth produced from flax grown in the area. He owned his own weaving apparatus. They used to spread out the finished cloth outdoor on the grass to bleach in the sun. They had two children, a son Michael and a daughter Mary. Now my father Michael seems to have led a carefree boyhood life, although they lived in a village on a farmland where at that time everybody had to work from sunrise to sunset, including the children from age 3 and up. Poland was then well over 90% farmland. The people were all peasant farmers and lived on what they could squeeze out of the soil. No farm machinery whatever, just wooden plows pulled by horses or oxen. Sowing, planting, harvesting, and threshing, all done manually. He did not have to do that. Instead, he helped his parents in weaving linen. According to what he used to tell me, his big hobby was hunting hares. A hare is an overgrown rabbit weighing between 18 to 24 pounds. He used to trap them in some type of wire snares. His hunting helped put meat on the dining table. Meat was scarce there. The only time people had meat was when they butchered a pig or a calf, and that was consumed mostly on special occasions such as the Easter holidays or weddings. He was quite an expert on skinning rabbits. When we were kids, he raised rabbits. After skinning a rabbit, he would cure the fur and make gloves for us. The meat he would season for a few days and roast it in a special way. That really made a very tasty meal. Some hundreds of years ago, Poland was a powerful independent nation stretching from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Black Sea in the south. At one time, putting an end to crusaders' invasions, pillagings of countries by defeating them at the Battle of Grunwald. Another time, the European continent was in danger of being overrun by the Turks. The King of Poland, Jan Sobieski, with his armies, defeated them at the Battle of Vienna. These were the days of the kings, emperors, princesses, counts, and so forth. They were great landlords, owning immense areas of land, including cities, towns, and villages. This was a system of feudal estate rule. The landlords were independent and all-powerful, having their own armies. Also, there were kings ruling the country as a whole. These landowners were so independent that some of them sometimes refused the call to arms of the king to repulse an enemy invasion. What was worse was that they were making land deals with neighboring gentry landowners, trading or selling, making land deals involving large areas of land they possessed. An example is where a large area was Poland was sold to a German prince and became Prussia. Another deal was where a large area of Poland bordering on the Baltic Sea was transferred and became Germany's East Prussia, which after World War I resulted in a controversial subject of establishing the Polish corridor to give Poland access to the Baltic Sea, thereby separating Germany's West Prussia from East Prussia, and was one of the reasons for Germany to attack Poland starting World War II. All this wheeling and dealing of the Polish gentry with neighboring counterparts resulted in Poland's shrinking of territory and power. The final result was partitioning of Poland by the royal rulers of neighboring countries of Germany, Russia, and Austria-Hungary in the year 1772. Germany took over the western and northern part, Russia the eastern, and Austria-Hungary the southern part of Poland. So it happened that our ancestors were located in the southern part of Poland and came under the rule of Emperor Franz Joseph of Austria-Hungary. He was of Roman Catholic faith and a fair ruler of the people under him. There was no compulsory educational program. Young people were free to acquire an education without limits, providing they or their parents had money to pay for it. And no less important, if they had time for it, as everybody was busy working on their farms to keep body and soul together. On the other hand, all young men attaining age 21 were subject to a compulsory military training law requiring them to serve a 3-year term in the armed forces. However, if a young man happened to be the only son in the family, then he was subject to a 6-month term in the army. And so it happened that father, being the only son in his family, he spent only 6 months in the army. Some young men, with the help of their relatives, would sneak out of the country to avoid military training. Such was not the case with father. People were afraid that there was to be a big war. The royal ruling families in the European continent, although in most cases were related by blood to each other, were competing among themselves and annexing parts of smaller, weaker countries, squabbling, arguing, and distrusting each other. This was the reason for compulsory military training. Austria-Hungary was allied with Germany, and its army training was under German command, and the young army recruits had to learn to understand the German language. The King of England was a brother to the Tsar of Russia and were allied on their side. Ironically, the Tsarina of Russia was related to Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany. The people were right. A World War I did erupt as a result of an assassination of Austrian Archduke in Serbia in the year 1914. It was a war to end all wars. This, as we know, did not prove true. But one definite result was, this was the end of the royal dynasties involved. It seems like soon after father's discharge from the army, approaching the age of 22, he took off for America. Under what circumstances and why, I do not know. Possibly the parents had saved enough money and made it possible for him to seek more secure and better future in a new country called America. He used to tell us about one of his parents' aunts and her family migrating to South America. They ended up in Brazil in a place called Curitiba. This was then wild country with no place to live. They had to hold up in a big rotted out tree for shelter. By chance, I have a copy of National Geographic magazine with a write-up about Brazil. In one instance, it describes the city of Curitiba, now a thriving metropolis. This must be the place, because a mention of Polish immigrants there is made. So indications show we may have blood relatives there. In the year 1900, at the age of 22, Father landed in America. Question is whether he had money. Did he know anybody to help him out in this new country? He could not read or write. Only language he knew was Polish and a little bit of German, not a word of English. All I know, he sometimes found a place to live and work in Bayonne, New Jersey. According to him, he worked in a nickel smelting place, talked a lot about Staten Island, and he pronounced it Stateland, and he lived somewhere near a Standard Oil refinery. There was an explosion once, and a fire so big, it was hard for him to describe. Big balls of fire floating in the air, everybody running for their lives. Heat so intense, it melted wheels of railroad cars. A saloon keeper running out and turning back into the building to pick up his money that he forgot in his hurry to run. Nobody ever saw him after that. At one time during the Depression in the 1930s, he had me start writing a diary about his live memories. Something came up. We never quite finished it, but most of his early life experiences were there. My biggest impression was his coming to America in 1900 and came here on a steamboat, the name of which I forgot. That took 3 weeks to cross the Atlantic Ocean. He kept an old steamer trunk where he kept all his documents and memorabilia. It all disappeared after his fourth and last marriage and final demise. The diary was there too. I sure wish we had possession of the contents of this trunk. I talked with the surviving widow about it, but very resulting information. Most likely all the articles of no value to her ended up in the trash can. I do not know when and under what circumstances he came to live in North Tonawanda, New York. I know he boarded at one time with a family named Rempawa, another time with a family named Barshevskis. That family moved to Detroit later. He moved around the section of Ironton, Simpson, Wheatfield Streets, and First Avenue. That's where he made most of his friendly contacts with friends he got to know while working for Tonawanda Ironworks. They were mostly Polish, Hungarian, and some Ukrainians. It was on January 17, 1905, he married my mother, Magdalena Basara, an Our Lady of Częstochowa Church, which was then in the third year of existence. The ceremony was performed by the late Reverend Peter Lajota, the first rector of the newly organized OLC parish. Witnesses were Stanley Micah and Mary Pashak. At that time, he was employed by Tonawanda Ironworks at a slack dump, dumping molten slack from the blast furnaces. There were two blast furnaces, sometimes just across River Road from the furnaces. Most of the time at the slack dump down Gratwick Way, what today is known as Gratwick Riverside Park, an area stretching from Felton Street to near Waiheke Hotel. I remember when during high water, the river reached River Road itself. My uncle Steve Pawlik and my cousin John Topolsky worked there too. Eventually, Tonawanda Iron dumped enough slack there to fill in the area from River Road to the present shoreline, and most places about 20 feet above river level. At one time, during the course of River Road survey, the civil engineers ran into a problem of who owned the area of the slag dump. It was not on a map, which only showed the river there. The slag dumping years later was discontinued there, and from then on, slag was dumped across River Road from blast furnaces, crushed and sold for road building. The Gratwick slag dump was leveled off by a firm established by late Clarence Hackett of Tonawanda, who was once mayor of that city. He made a fortune on that deal, bringing the heavy machinery to crush the slag for road building at the same time, digging up a large amount of iron that, due to old-fashioned process at the blast furnaces, happened to get mixed with the slag. This iron was sold to iron and steel foundries. On April 12, 1906, I was born, their first child. It was on a Palm Sunday in a home on 7th Avenue, later owned by Vazin family. It's still there on the south side of 7th Avenue, about 6 or 7 houses from Martin Street. I was baptized April 16, 1906, at Old Sea Church. My godfather was Anthony Polak, and godmother was my aunt Agata Novak, mother's sister. Sometimes later, we moved to a house at 15 6th Avenue, next to my godfather's home. There, sometimes in July 1907, a baby girl was born. Things went bad. All births were handled by midwives. My mother contracted childbirth infection and fever, which resulted in her death at the age of 26. On July 27, 1907, I was then 15 months old. The baby girl died also, was laid in the same casket with mother. While my mother and sister were laid out in the casket at our home, my godfather's house next door caught on fire, and there was danger of fire spreading to our house. The fire department then had only horse-drawn fire wagons, which took some time to get to the location of the fire. Emergency action was taken by people involved in their neighbors. A Mrs. Schiebecker across the street had her furniture removed from her parlor so that my mother's casket could be transferred and placed there if necessary. However, the firemen came in time to prevent the fire spreading to our home. My mother was buried in St. Francis Cemetery. Location of grave is in the southwest corner of the cemetery. I know the approximate spot next to the cinder path. 70 years have gone by, and it's hard to locate the actual grave. She was buried next to old Zidel, whose family had a wooden cross marker. It's not there anymore. What followed is that chronological dates indicate that father got married again within a matter of months. Reason for hasty action was most likely because he had to have someone to take care of me, a 15-month motherless boy. For a while, my godfather's sister, Mrs. Carl Pisker, was my caretaker. I do not know the date of father's second marriage, but what I can recall of conversations between older folks, I can only deduct of how it happened. My godfather and neighbor, Tony Pollack, came to town from Buffalo, and he had a lot of friends there. One of the most popular spots for socializing he knew in Buffalo was a saloon and a dance hall known as Pomana's Place. People were migrating here from Poland, most of them young and single. It was places like Pomana's where they would meet, get acquainted, and pick their future spouses. Nobody told me that, but I'm quite sure Godfather Tony Pollack took him there, and that's where he found the girl that became his second wife. Her name was Sophia Bizon, B-I-Z-O-N. She was born in Poland, one of the four sisters in the family. They lived somewhere near the city Rzeszów, same southern part of Poland as my father. Her oldest sister, Mary, remained in Poland, while the rest of them left their home while very young, looking for work as housemaids or whatever they could find. The three girls' names were Kasia, Catherine, Rosia, Rose, and Sophia Sophie. They moved around quite a bit in areas south of Poland, but it seems they spent a lot of their time in West Prussia, Germany. Attesting to that is the fact that they could speak high and low German language fluently. I used to get a kick out of them conversing together in front of Father. He would get upset because he did not understand what they were talking about. In time, they decided to migrate across the Atlantic Ocean and landed in Canada. From there, they came to Buffalo, got jobs working in restaurants. Tasha Katie got a job as a cook in a Chinese restaurant named Fan Ting. The Courier Express had a write-up about it several years ago. It was famous at one time. There, she learned more about cooking in later years. She was a chef in some of the big hotels in Detroit. My brother Julian knows more about that. He stayed with her for a while. She was making big money, never got married. In clothes, she would wear nothing but the best with matching colors from head to toes. We lost track of her after the Depression and World War II. Don't know what happened to her. Must be dead by now. Rose married a man by the name of Niedźwiecki. They lived here in North Tonawanda. Their marriage did not work out. Her husband left her sometime in the early 1920s. They had four children. The oldest, Anna, married to a Joseph Zakrzewski. He lives now in Buffalo. Kathy married a wealthy man. Don't know the name or their whereabouts. Son Stanley died some 20 years ago. Son Joseph Niedźwiecki, Neri, married a Paiung girl here in town. He worked as an electrician at the Wurlitzer Company. Presently resides with his wife in an apartment above Rojek's Barbershop on Oliver Street. He is disabled with paralysis and a wheelchair patient. Their mother died several years ago in an institution. The oldest of the sisters, Mary, who remained in Poland, died before World War I through an accident while handling a kerosene lamp which broke, spilling burning fuel on her, and she burnt to death. She raised a family of six or seven boys. One of them is Joseph Drust, who the sisters brought over to this country. He lives in Depew, New York. He is now an 84-year-old widower. In his days, was very active around the church and community life. He is a charter member and organizer of the Polish Falcon Club in Depew. Sophie, married my father, and she became my stepmother. We still lived at 15 6th Avenue, but not for long. Sometime soon, they bought the old Topolsky homestead at number 60 6th Avenue. Her sister Kasia, Catherine, helped out by lending them money through a mortgage. My brother Benny was born September 3rd, 1908. Now, I do not know where it was at 15 6th Avenue, or was it at 60 6th Avenue. All I remember is that it was my job to rock his cradle. When her nephew, Joe Drust, was getting married, she insisted on going to the wedding. Father could not go because of his work, so he had to buy her a new hat and give her permission to go to the wedding of Joseph Drust in Depew. Benny, being just a baby, she decided to take him along. I had to go along, too, as his cradle rocker. By then, I was a little over 2 years old. I haven't forgot the experiences to this day. For transportation, we had to go by trolley cars. First, the old Lockport trolley to Fillmore Avenue and Broadway in Buffalo, then transferred to a Broadway trolley to City Line, where we transferred to a suburban trolley, which looked like a Turnerville trolley, and we used to see in the comics. The wedding was at the bride's home. When they all went to church, I had to rock the cradle. The bride's sister had one. After they came from church, I must have fallen asleep and don't remember much. In the evening, I was impressed by the gas lights on the walls. At home, we had kerosene lamps. Then I was impressed by one-man band orchestra, an accordion player and his foot, drums, and cymbals. After that, it was all blank. I don't remember when and how we got back home. To describe another branch on the Topolsky family tree, I have to refer back to Poland. Some years before father left for America, his sister Mary had a baby boy, unfortunately out of wedlock. Eventually, she got married, but not to the baby's father. She married a man by the name of John Ijak. They later had three or four daughters. Her husband John came over to America. He got a job, saved some money, went back to Poland. He built them a new home, left them some money, and came back to Buffalo, where he worked as a riveter, helper building steam boilers. He was saving money. His pay was above average. Afraid to trust banks, he deposited his money with a saloon keeper. With a stock market crash and depression, he lost his job, decided to go back to Poland. So he asked the saloon keeper for his money, $13,000. Saloon keeper denied taking any money from him. And as John Ijak had nothing showing he ever gave him the money, John found himself on the street with only some loose change in his pockets. While working at the boiler works as a riveter helper, he lost his hearing. Almost completely deaf and destitute, he was placed in the Erie County Poorhouse at Windy, New York, where he died in a short period of time. My dad was notified and asked to come over to identify the body and provide necessary information to complete the certificate of death. I drove my father there in our old Buick car. We were taken into the morgue. They pulled out the slab with the body on it, covered by white cloth. The head rested on a wooden block. It was John Ijak's body, father's brother-in-law. After identification and giving necessary information, we left the mortuary. There was nobody to claim the remains, so it was left to the Erie County Welfare for disposition, and what happened after that, I do not know. We could not help, as it was the time of deepest depression and needed help ourselves. John Ijak had a sister, Mrs. Smela, and a brother, Dominic Ijak, in North Tonawanda. They were themselves on welfare and could not help. Incidentally, the brother, Dominic Ijak, lived here in North Tonawanda, was married, and had a large family of children. One of his children is the Palatine Father's Rector, Reverend Stanley Ijak. Although raised in poverty, these children are all grown up and doing well, and they are active, well-behaved, and an asset to our community. Now, we have to go back to father's sister Mary and her firstborn out of wedlock, baby boy. Father's mother, my grandmother, took over the baby, gave him the name of John Topolsky, and raised him as her own. This is my impression of what happened. When father got firmly established here, it seems that things were arranged and John Topolsky was brought over the ocean to come and live with us. There was only myself and Benny as children at that time. Well, I vaguely recall bits of arguments and friction between father and my stepmother concerning the status of John Topolsky, father's nephew, and John Drust, stepmother's nephew. I believe that outcome was that John Topolsky left our house and boarded here and there with other families. At first, he worked for Tonawanda Iron Works, and then the old paper mill in Tonawanda, New York. He seemed to be always confused as to his relationship to father, calling him my brother, and father would show an expression of resentment on his face, but he never would say a word about it. Jan Topolsky finally got married. To me, it seems like in the late 1920s, and they had four children. It was during the Depression. He was unemployed. His wife's brother got him a job in a company bakery in Buffalo, and they moved there to be closer to his job. Just a couple of years later, a catastrophe hit the family. Jan's wife died of, I believe, tuberculosis. There he was a widower with four small children. He succeeded in placing them in the Felician Sisters orphanage. One thing I'll never forget about him being a good father is that he visited motherless children every Sunday of the week, regardless of all obstacles, rain, sunshine, snow, or blizzard. Coincidentally, our Eddie Topolsky happened to be in the same orphanage at the same time. Every time we went to see Eddie, we always saw John and his children. Time came when the children grew up in their teens. Father brought Eddie home, and John rented a house and brought his children home. John died sometime in the 1960s. His children all married, and their children are getting married now. Because I feel these children are definitely our blood relatives, I hereby state their names and addresses. Mr. and Mrs. Anthony Barbara Gorski, 39 Charles Crest Court, Buffalo, New York, 14224. Mr. and Mrs. John Topolsky, 780 Eagle Street, Buffalo, New York, 14210. Mr. and Mrs. Anna Sokolinsky, 7069 North Gowanda State Road, Hamburg, New York, 14075. Mr. and Mrs. Harold Bertha Laprell, 1326 Clinton Street, Cheektowaga, New York, 14206. Barbara's husband, Tony Gorski, works at Chevrolet plant in town of Tonawanda. One of his sisters is a Felician nun, Sister Mary Advenet, reaching fourth grades at our OLC school in North Tonawanda, New York. John Topolsky is employed at University of Buffalo as a maintenance man. Anna's husband, Mike Sokolinsky, works at Bethlehem Steel as a welder. Anna is running a restaurant named Eden Center Snack Spot, Route 75, Exit 56. Bertha's husband, Harold Laprell, works at Bethlehem Steel as an electrician. He seems to be a jack of all trades, with electronics his specialty. On November 11, 1911, my brother Julian was born. I never forget that day. Father did not go to work that day. Just as it was getting daylight, he sent me to a Mrs. Kramer to come to the house quick. She was a midwife, and I lived in the house where Rojek's barbershop used to be. The date of 11th year always fascinates me. I'm not sure, but it could be the time also was 11 a.m. So it seems Uncle Julie was born with all aces. Perhaps that is why he is a businessman. Even his young age, business was his obsession. To me, that date was the time I was made to wash diapers, beginning with Julie, ending with my sister Mary as a baby. Come to think of it, November 11th is also Amos' Day. What connotation does this fact imply, I do not know. So much for Julian's birthday. I was about 5 1/2 years old then. About that time, a couple of men came over to our house looking for board. Somebody recommended our house as a boarding house. There were Russians from the city of Minsk on the Russian-Polish border. One of them, Nikolai Nazarevich, said it was a teacher. The other man was his brother, Andrei Nazarovich. After a lengthy discussion, they were taken in as boarders. Father, working for the Tonawanda Ironworks, was making only $9 a week, working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. Once every 2 weeks, he had to work 18 hours to get 18 hours off while changing shifts. It was figured out that with the family growing, a few extra dollars would come in handy. The amount of board the men agreed to pay was $3 per month. That included a place to sleep, doing their laundry and food preparations. As for food, they each had their credit book at Siren's Grocery and Butcher Shop. The average weekly bill was about $1 per week. These men, after a while, wrote back to their folks in the old country, which in turn resulted in an avalanche of Russians coming over to our place. When we ran out of room, they spread out to other places. They were getting newspapers from Russia. At one time at that little house on 6th Avenue, there were 18 boarders besides ourselves. In a barn Father built were two cows, one calf, and a pig. Beds and cots were particularly in every nook and cranny. Then the First World War came. Lack of workers in factories. Wages jumped from $1 per day to 45 cents to 50 cents per hour. The boarders were saving their money. As the war progressed, a revolution broke out. In Russia, the Tsar was overthrown and liquidated. The Bolsheviks took over. The boarders were happy. A new order was coming to their country. And after some time, they decided to go back to their old country. There would now be freedom, equality for everyone. The new government would take care and provide everything needed for all concerned. There would be no need for money, just a membership card showing you were a worker entitled to whatever was needed. There would not be any private moneyed individuals. Everything would be owned and shared by everybody. The boarders all got together making plans for a return to their homeland. Everything was working out perfect. Well, almost everything. But what about the money that they saved up? No use taking the money with them. There would be no need for money over there. The problem was solved, however. With the money they saved, they bought jewelry of descriptions, gold watches, diamond rings, and so forth, winding up the affairs they took off for Russia. Most of them did, although some of them stayed. Particularly, all of them are dead now. Their survivors are still here. Names like Lazarevich, Lutsevich, Stuba, and a few others. Of those that reached Russia, we only heard from them once. Our first boarder, Nikolai Nazarevich, had a letter smuggled over the Polish border addressed to an old man, Yashinsky, the originator of Yashinsky Shoe Store, where they used to hang around because he came from Poland, the area of Lithuania, Poland, and Russia, and had a lot in common to talk about. In that letter, Nikolai was begging him on bended knees to please contact their countrymen who elected to remain here and ask them in God's name to make a collection and extend their efforts to bring them back to this country. Mentioned was that one of them, Tony Kubitsky, has become a commissar. That is the end of it. Nobody ever heard any more about anyone of them again. Going back a few years prior to the First World War, us kids were taken care of by a mother who was very active in the community life, making many friends. Being fluent in German language was as good or sometimes better than English. With people migrating here, having no education, they would run into problems, legal and otherwise. They would come to her for help as their interpreter, using her knowledge of German. That cut a lot of ice, as number of people in the area were of German descent. As for us little children, she did the best she could concerning our health and welfare. Whenever we got sick, she used all kinds of herbs and home remedies and procedures, knowledge of which she acquired in Europe. Doctors were never called in, unless in cases of absolute necessity. My brothers, Benny and Julian, once took sick with diphtheria. And Dr. Terashinsky was called. He was Polish, but could only speak English. He gave them shots, and they got well. Everybody regarded diphtheria as a 24-hour killer disease. It was either Benny or Julie, I do not recall, got diphtheria again, and some doctor got him well again. We went through a series of sicknesses, such as measles and mumps. For colds, she would fix up a concoction of sulfur syrup, molasses, and fried onions. And what else, I do not recall. Terrible stuff to swallow. Castor oil without orange juice was always on hand. Also, senna leaves, tea for constipation. I hated that because it always gave me an acute bellyache, but it never failed. The city at that time had no filtration plant, and the water that came from our faucets was raw Niagara River water, which caused some cases of typhoid fever. I do not remember if there was any milk dairies in town. We drank our tea and coffee without milk. I remember some children walking around bow-legged. Their condition was caused by calcium needed to build and strengthen their bones structures. That condition was called rickets and was caused by lack of milk and their diets. Bad teeth was in the same category. Only time we saw a dentist is when the side of the mouth swelled up with a terrible toothache which had to be pulled. Sometimes that was done at home by wrapping one end of the string around the aching tooth and the other end of the string tied to a doorknob, with somebody on the other side of the door yanking it open unexpectedly. This is no joke. It was actually done on a few occasions. Now that Mom and Dad saved up some money by taking in boarders, they bought a cow so we could have milk in our diet. But there was a problem. Us kids were so used to drinking black coffee that we could not drink it with milk in it. Took several spankings on our behinds before we got used to coffee with milk. Mother always boiled the milk we drank, having knowledge that raw milk was unsafe to drink. Having a cow giving us plenty of milk, she would skim that cream to make butter, and the resultant buttermilk, which went good with hot buttered mashed potatoes. She also made sour milk and farmer's cheese, which was used to make potatoes and cheese pierogi. We still had milk left over, which was sold to other families. It was my job getting up before sunup and deliver the milk to the customers before going to school at 8 a.m. Well, we first marched in a group to attend Holy Mass in church. Many a time I was late and had to sneak in a group without the nun teacher seeing me do that. At times I would be caught sneaking in. I always was ready with some excuse I cooked up beforehand. Did not always work. I figured some excuses were better than none, if it did not work. The nun teacher had me stay after school to make matters worse. I had more explaining to do when I got home late from school. We were getting more customers for milk. Mom and Dad bought another cow. I had to make more deliveries, carrying 6-quart round pails of milk at one time, 3 in each hand. Boy, how I hated those snow drifts and winters. So much for that. Any more would fill out a book. It was about this time the father decided to look for a different job. The slack dump job was all right. There was a lot of time between slack train trips, sometimes enough to row across the river in a rowboat they had, to Edgewater Park, an amusement park on Grand Island, for some beer. But the hours were long, 12 hours per day, 7 days a week, for $9 per week. He tried a job at National Radiator Foundry, located then between 8th Avenue Alley and the Buffalo Bolt plant. It was discontinued and turned down about the year 1929. He was employed as a radiator molder trainee. And a lot of local men worked there as molders at a quarter piece work rate of pay. That meant they were paid so much for each mold produced and were free to go home any time after finishing any number of molds set up for each floor by the company. Usually starting anytime early in the morning, most of them were done by 1 p.m. The molds were then poured in the afternoon by another gang. The pay was very good. That tried it, but did not stay there very long. Then I believe he tried Buffalo Steel Company. It was an old-fashioned steam-driven rolling mill producing angle iron, steel fence posts, flat rolled steel, square rods for wrought iron fences. These products were made from old rejected railroad and trolley rails, slitted by a machine in three parts, top, center, and bottom. It was all heavy, hard, and hot work. Above all that, it was a very primitive and dangerous place to work in. Too many people were being hurt or permanently crippled. Father did not stay there very long either. About that time, old Henry Ford was making his headways and starting to mass produce what we then called Tin Lizzie's Ford automobiles with brass radiators, and was hiring a mass of production workers on terms which then were considered radical. His philosophy was to pay workers $1 per hour, cutting down the hours of work per day from 12 to 10 to 8 per day. His idea was to give his employees more leisure time to spend for themselves and more money to spend, which would stimulate business and make it possible for them to own their own automobiles. Most likely, Fords, which sold for a lot less than any other makes. This was when Father decided to go to Detroit and work for Ford Motor Company. He went by a lake passenger boat, which then was plying between Buffalo, New York, Cleveland, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan. It was a lot cheaper to go by boat than a railroad passenger train. He had a place where to go and board, a family named Vujicic. The lady of the family was boarding in our house when a single girl coming from Poland. Arrangements were made, and he boarded there. He got a job at the Ford Foundry. For what reason, I do not know, but he came back after a length of time. He had a lot of stories to tell. The immensity of the plant, the timing and regulations of all movements and procedures of manufacture, synchronization all throughout the plant, the mass of population in the city, people going to and from work, hopping on the trolley cars, taking people to work, followed one another, never stopping, just slowing down enough for workers to hop another. Also, the Ford Company screened all prospective employees. Only those with a clean bill of health and character were hired. After that, they were being checked on their behavior. Drunkenness, absenteeism, cleanliness, and so forth were closely watched. They had to toe the line or else. Why Father left Detroit, I have no knowledge. I just presume that on his part, he got homesick and worrying about the family he left in North Tonawanda. Both Mom and Dad missed each other very much. He must have also faced the problem that to keep his job at Ford's required relocation his family, moving into the city of Detroit. He loved his home in North Tonawanda, and the hustle and bustle in Detroit was a little too much for him and also would be for his family. So it was, in all probability, it was decided between Mom and Dad that he come back home. He did on the same lake boat. I'm not sure, but I think the First World War was already in progress, which to him meant he would not encounter any difficulty in getting a job in his hometown. On December 2, 1913, my brother Walter was born. I do not remember the details on the day of his birth, although I have plenty to remember him as a baby before he started to walk. Of course, there were more diapers for me to wash, but what I remember most was that he was a very cranky baby, always crying. I had a job of carrying him in my arms, trying to humor him, entertain and pacify him. My arms were aching so much from carrying him around, knocking on windows, trying to interest him in the kids playing outside, all to no avail. Sometimes his mother accused me of pinching him, his behind, so he would cry louder and have to take him off my arms. I think there was something bothering him physically, causing some discomfort. All in all, it finally got so bad that Mom and Dad hired my cousin, Catherine Svinuch, as his babysitter and entertainer. She did a good job and took a load off my arms. In time, baby Walter settled down, becoming an average toddler. On August 8, 1914, my brother Constant Cody was born. I do not remember the details of his birth either, just more diapers to wash. He's quite a well-behaved baby. Perhaps that is why I do not recall much of his babyhood. Just one item. When it came to giving him his first name, his mother insisted to be Constante, or Kostek for short in Polish. When he went to school and got accepted to high school, he put his name down as Constance Topolsky, with the result that his graduating year he received a lot of pamphlets, brochures, and so forth from different colleges soliciting his enrollment. All of these were addressed to Miss Constance Topolsky. It came from colleges for girls. He was embarrassed. I think ever since then he puts his name down as Mr. Constance Topolsky. As for us at home, after some time and difficulty, we chose to call him Cody for short. On February 24, 1917, my sister Mary was born. Her mother was the happiest woman on earth. She finally became a mother of a baby girl for which she prayed for years. One day the mother told me that if anything happened to her, me being the oldest of all the children, she wanted me to look out for her daughter, Mary, and take good care of her. I often wonder, what made her ask me to do that? Did she have some kind of premonition? Possibly. Sometimes in late fall of the following year, 1918, the mother died of Spanish influenza, of which there was a worldwide epidemic. Little Mary was about 18 months of age at that time. Going back to the time Father was in Detroit, I now remember it was in the late 1915, as I remember that. I was in the third grade at the OC school. My first day of school was in the year 1912. Wanda Zizitsky, later Mrs. Voyevoda, told me in later years that it was her that took me to school the first day. My stepmother and her mother were very good friends. I still remember those first year school days. Our parish rector, Reverend Stanley Bubach, at that time, was building the present old rectory, and us school kids were having fun using the carpenter's sawhorses and planks for seesaws. Wanda had two brothers then, Roman and Benny. I remember them well, because during Christmas season, prior to our Christmas vacation, the nun teachers had them both draw Santa Claus and Christmas scenes copied from pictures on all blackboards in school. They sure did have a lot of artistic talents and did wonderful drawings and colors, colored crayons, filling out whole blackboards. Roman was a happy-go-lucky extrovert type. His health was not too good, and he died in his late boyhood. Benny was a quiet type. He never bothered anybody. An introvert in nature, he kept more or less to himself. So it was while the First World War was in progress that Father came back from Detroit. He got a job in the old paper mill in Tonawanda, New York. He did not work too long there. The Buffalo Bolt Company had difficulty in buying coiled wire and steel bars for bolt making because of shortage of steel. So the company decided to build a rolling mill and produce their own steel coils and bars out of scrap steel. Construction was started, and Father applied for and got a job with the construction gang as a laborer. When the mill was finally built and equipped ready for production, Father applied for and got the job in the rolling mill, cutting scrap for the mill, then chasing the overhead traveling crane, and finally got on a billet reheating crew as a charger on a billet furnace. The company did not have much success in making their own wire and rods from scrap. A change was made. The building enlarged and system changed to rolling steel billets. They bought mostly from Lackawanna steel mills. Sizes of billets range from 2 1/4 inch to 4 inches in diameter, all 15 feet long. Again, the building was enlarged. The present mill consisted of 3 sections. Original section in the middle, 1 addition on the north end, another addition on the south end. Time after time, modifications were made, and at one time, the mill was considered the fastest and most versatile of the mills in the country. Rolling stock into sizes from 5/16 round wire to 1 1/2 inch round bars, the record of continuous service in the rolling mill for the Topolsky family shows as follows. Father Michael, 27 years. Tony, 48 years. Benny, 32 years. Julian, 2 years. A total of 109 years. In the year 1917, the United States was forced to declare war on Germany. And that is when things really began to happen. The war itself did not affect our family too much, just shortages of certain food items. There was no government rationing. One item hard to buy was sugar. Me and my cousin Walter Pavlik would go to the stores from local area to as far as Main Street in Tonawanda, New York, trying to buy sugar. Usually when some stores would have some sugar, we had to buy other items, and the storekeeper would allow us to buy 9 1/4 pounds of sugar. These stores were far and few between. To sweeten our coffee, we used corn syrup, condensed milk in cans. Sometimes we were lucky when we got brown sugar, that is sugar made of beets. The real calamity came when the then called Spanish influenza epidemic struck the world. People were dying at such a rate, the cemetery people could not keep pace in digging graves fast enough. In Buffalo, they would stack up coffins on the surface awaiting burial. I was altar boy at our OLC church then. We usually had from 1 to 3 funerals every day. I lost a lot of school time. The flu hit our family too, and drastically changed the course of our lives and derailed our destinies for the future. My stepmother and mother of children, one day she decided to make a trolley trip to Buffalo at a request from Mrs. Angeline Sumba, who was my cousin, to go to the Dold Meat Packing Company Stockyards to help her pick out a cow. Mrs. Sumba decided to buy to provide more milk for her children. She made the trip. Although the father was against it. The day was wet and dreary, with cold, moist, continuous rain late in the fall. I cover up for her as I did many times before, and had supper ready when Dad would come home from work. She did not make it back home before Dad came home from work. So the cat was out of the bag. An argument followed, but Mom sweet buttered him and all was forgiven. The following day, Father went to work as usual at 6 a.m. Mom milked the cows. I delivered the milk, ready to go to school, when she asked me to go to the rolling mill gate and ask someone at the gate to find Dad and tell him to come home immediately because she was very sick. He came home, put her to bed, treated her for a cold. Nothing helped. After a couple of days, she got sicker. A Dr. Krantz was called. They diagnosed the sickness as the flu. There was no cure for it, except that alcohol may help. The doctor said to get her some cognac, which we did. But she progressively got worse. Finally, the day came when she would breathe her last. A group of neighboring women were at the bedside praying for a quick end to her misery. There was no hope. She was gasping for breath, unable to move or talk. Finally, one of the women said some people dying had a hard time because they were angry at someone who was a friend at one time. It happened that she was on a very friendly terms with a Mrs. Kubinets, who with her husband had a bakery shop on Oliver Street, presently Francis Bakery. It so happened that two of the Kubinets' sons played a prank on my brother Benny, who was bringing the cows in from the pasture one day in the past. Going by the bakery, the boys took the rope of the cow and hung Benny up on a power pole by his feet. Somebody got Benny loose. The incident resulted in a heavy argument and an end to the friendship between Mother and Mrs. Kubinets. They were still not on speaking terms. After some discussion, Dad told me to go to the bakery and ask Mrs. Kubinets to please come to our house, as Mother had a hard time breathing her last, and that her presence may help her pass away. On my way down, I started to run across Oliver Street near 7th Avenue. I heard an automobile honking. Looking to my left, I saw that I was about to be run over, so I turned to my right and ran as fast as I could. The car touched me, but it did not knock me down. So I ran across, never stopped to look back, ran into the bakery shop, all out of breath. Mrs. Kubinets came and looked at me in a shocked way and asked me what happened. For about 5 minutes, I could not say a word, just crying. Finally, I blubbered out. Mother was dying, and Father was asking her to come over to our house to pray for her. She lost no time in coming over, spoke to Mother, and joined the others present in prayers. Papa was broken up and stayed out of sight for some time. Somebody lit a holy candle, put it in Mother's hand, and they had me hold her hand with the candle with both my hands. After about a half an hour, she turned her eyes, looking at me with a pitiful gaze, like she wanted me to promise her something. Then her body seemed to relax and became still. That was it, at her age of 32 years. For Father, his life took a radical turn. Whereas before, he put his 12 hours in at the plant. Coming home, he would have his supper and then read his paper, which took a number of hours, then go to bed. Mother took care of the household details. He had no other worries. Oh, yes. By that time, he could read. He learned how to do that by himself. As for writing,
He learned how to sign his name, Michael Topolsky, but never did any other writing. Now, all of a sudden, he became a widower with six children, ranging in age from 11 years to 18 months. His job, his home, his children were all his responsibilities. I would say he did the best he could. Got himself and the whole situation under control. First thing he did was to shop around for a housekeeper, which resulted in young families to move in with us. The lady of the house would do all the work in the house with the help of the children, who could be of any use, depending on their age and ability. So for a short number of years, till he got married for the third time, we had families moving in and out. They never lasted too long due to lack of living space, massive work involved. They all had children of their own, which situation did not always fit in. They did not agree with our children, causing friction. One good thing was, these families came in as friends, willing to help us, and when moving out, parted as friends. The war ended November 11, 1918. In the year 1919, our old overseas school burned down. The parish rented empty dairy store on Fifth Avenue, and a store where Ruzicki Hardware is now, that only took in a small amount of children. Others had to go to public schools. Me and the late Julius Valens were the first ones to get accepted to Felton Grammar High School, where I graduated. Julius Valens continued and graduated from Felton High School. I took in 1 year of high school, but the week of final examination, I got my working papers at the age of 14, never took the exam, went to work for Buffalo Bolt Company. In the year 1920, there was a post-war depression. Practically all factories were affected, a period of great unemployment. Father got laid off, but he found a job with a contractor, concrete paving Ward Road, from the city line to Niagara Falls Boulevard. He had a back-breaking job of spreading cement dumped from a steam-operated concrete mixer. That was done manually with hand shovels. He got me a job there also as a water boy. Gradually, business picked up and hiring of workers began. In places where new workers were being hired, questions were asked, such as, are you a member of the labor union? If the answer was affirmative, applicant was told to work. No work was available for him. During the war, a new union movement got a start. The 1920 depression put a stop to that. That period, some more modifications were done at the rolling mill and work was resumed. Father got called back to work again. I went back to work at the Buffalo Bolt. Quit because it was too heavy for me. Got a job at Wilson Box Shop in Tonawanda, where Colonial Ford is now located. Then I went to work at Niagara Radiator Machine Shop. From there back to Buffalo Bolt. Father asked me to come to work in the rolling mill where I worked 1 year. The pay was higher. Father needed the money. The kids were growing up. I quit. Too many hours. 12 hours per day, 6 days a week. I was only 17 years of age and raring to go out and have some fun with the other young people. I got a job at the Buffalo Pump Company foundry as an overhead crane operator. I liked the job there. But that also lasted 1 year. They were getting ready to close the foundry. And that type of work was done at Buffalo Forge, which was the parent company in Buffalo. So I had no work.
could not find any. So Dad asked me to come back to the rolling mill. And there I stayed till 1973, retirement after 48 years of continuous service for the Buffalo Bolt and then Roblin Steel. During the course of between 1918 and about 1923, about five different families moved in and out of our house. The names of the families I can remember are George Bonschik, Dominic Ijak, Peter Ritzai, Josephine Franczak, and Waller Nalepka. Father was at wit's end. He decided to do something on a more permanent basis. He met a widow named Catherine Dujic, maiden last name Lehovich, courted her, and they decided to get married. She had two children, a daughter Mary and a son Stanley. By her first husband, Dujic, they did get married, and things began to form a normal family life again. One thing happened. My sister's name was Mary, and my stepsister's name was also Mary. So we had two Marys in the house. When somebody mentioned Mary, the rest of us did not know which Mary. The problem was solved. My sister Mary, we called Little Mary, and my stepsister, we called her Big Mary. They're about the same age and slept in the same baby bed. That marriage produced two more children. On March 1st, 1928, my sister Josephine was born. That same year, I got married. It was April 28, 1925. Both me and my wife, Julia Bratovo, were 19 years of age. Her mother died in 1923 and her sister in 1924. We both went through rough times and decided to start our own life together. On January 12, 1927, our Eddie was born, the last of the first generation of Topolskis in North Tonawanda, New York. Sometime soon after Eddie's birth, stepmother Catherine began to lose her health, throat trouble, and a hoarse speech. I was then already married and was not aware of all details of her illness. I know she was admitted to Myers Memorial Hospital in Buffalo. I was there to visit her a couple of times. She died of what I understand was cancer. Me and Julia Bratovo took in Josephine for some time, and Eddie, just a baby of several months, was put into a German orphanage on Dodge Street in Buffalo. I think when Eddie got to be 2 years old, he was transferred to the Felician Sisters Orphanage in Cheektowaga, New York, and stayed there till his early teens when Father brought him home. After Father lost his third wife, he began to manage things by himself. The children were growing up. Benny got a job. About the year 1927, he began working with us in the rolling mill. Then Julie got a job in the silk mill, and then Walter at the Archie Jones Lumber Company. In a little while, the kids themselves helped out. Stepsister Mary stayed with us and worked in an ice cream parlor. Her brother Stanley could not find a job. He was a bit of a prankster and up to all kinds of tricks. The kid had a lot of energy and guts. He tried to join the U.S. Army. They did not want him. He tried the Navy, but did not pass his physical because of a chipped front tooth that he received doing tricks, accidentally chipping the tooth.
So he took off to see the world on his own. Hopping trains, he landed in the state of California. He happened to be in the city of San Francisco when a Standard Oil Company gasoline tanker ship in port had a series of explosions. Everybody rushed to see what was going on. Stanley Dujic happened to be there. He ran also to see the fire, as usual. He had to be first and closest to what was going on. Unfortunately, he got to be right on the edge of the dock when another explosion rocked the area. Some way, it resulted in him falling off the dock into the water and landed on a protruding spile with his back breaking his spine and causing his death. I received a telegram of notification from the county sheriff and letter following his photograph for the purpose of identification and disposition of the body. Because we were in the middle of depression and unable to finance his burial, that decision was left to the San Francisco civil authorities and the oil company. And so life went on. Benny got married. Then Julie got married. Waller got married. Then Cody got married. The Second World War exploded. Little Mary got married. It was only Big Mary, Josephine, and Eddie left home. Father used to take his laundry to Mrs. Helen Pietrzykowski to be done. First thing we knew, wedding plans were in the making for the two of them. Big Mary came over to live with me and Julia Bratovo. She was then keeping company with Joe Lewis, who was in turn drafted into the Army. He took officers' training courses and came out as a lieutenant. He was assigned to a fort in Texas. Mary went there, and they got married. When Joe was ready to be shipped over the European theater of war, he brought her back here, rented out a house for her, near us on Rosebrook Terrace, or in that vicinity. I do not recall it. Anyway, it was within walking distance from our house. In the meantime, Josephine came to live with us. At that time, Father was hard up and making the decision whether to get married again or not. He was very shaky about it and asked a lot of people for advice whether to get married or not get married. He asked me. I told him not to get married. Benny said he was old enough to decide for himself. I tried to break it up, but I could not get any support from other members of the family. So the wedding finally materialized. To this day, I have a feeling it was against Father's better judgment to allow himself to be tied to this marital tie, that there was something that made him go through with it. After the wedding, funny incidents were occurring, which later turned into serious matters. Eddie got in trouble with his new stepmother. Came to me asking us if he could move in with us. We would like to have him with us, but we already had Josephine. The old lady hated both of them, so advised Eddie to go to Julian in his restaurant. He would have it good there, and Julian could use his help in the business. My theory or line of thought was that if we kept both Josephine and Eddie, the old lady would only have meat to pick on. But if Eddie went to live with Julian, then she would have two of us to pick on. That is how Eddie found himself living at Julian's place. First thing that the old lady did was to have him, Father, change beneficiaries on all insurance policies, making her the legal beneficiary as his wife. She was fit to be tied that Father did not own the house they lived in. Sometime before they got married, Dad sold the house to my brother Julian, who in turn paid up the mortgage and paid Father the amount of money they agreed on. Father paid bills he owed. He even gave Mary Lewis several hundred dollars as the amount of money left her by her mother, of which he had control through surrogate court when Mary was under legal age. The stepmother decided to have them go live someplace else. My sister Mary and her husband Eddie Brzezinski had the two-family house on 3rd Avenue, and the upper flat was vacant. Arrangements were made for them to move there. Father wallpapered the rooms and got ready to move over to Mary's place. When it came time to move, he broke down and cried, refusing to leave the home he lived in for most of his life, and which held so many precious memories for him. And that was that. Nobody could make him leave his house. Not long after that, his health started to fail. The doctor indicated arterial cirrhosis, hardening of the arteries, affecting his heart. Once he spent a few days in bed, but insisted on going back to work. The doctors prescribed his tablets, which he was required to carry with him, so that if he happened to be out someplace and felt an attack coming, to take a tablet and stop at the nearest place available where he could get a couple shots of whiskey. Beer was forbidden. One time in the mill, the foreman sent me out to Julian's for his tablets that he forgot fully and left at Julian's place. Finally, the day came when late in the evening he went to the bathroom and got an attack. Must have made some noise. There was company at home. Hearing a commotion, they ran to the bathroom and found him bleeding from the mouth. Took him to the hospital. Dr. Bible said a small vein burst open in his lungs, and he had a slight chance if the break closed up before infection set in. The infection did set in, resulting in pneumonia. Benny, myself, and Julie took turns keeping vigil at his bedside. One night it was my turn. I finished my shift at the mill, 11:30 p.m., and stayed in the hospital till Julian showed up and took over. It was all a matter of time. I went home to sleep. Julian stayed there till 8 or 9 o'clock when he suddenly remembered something he had to take care of at the restaurant. He ran out, figuring he would be back in a half an hour or so. When he did get back to the hospital, it was too late. Father was gone forever. What really was a heart-rending fact was that this was the Christmas week of year 1945. The funeral and burial was on Christmas Eve, the very day of each year he enjoyed the most, the Christmas Eve supper and a family reunion. Taking pride and rejoicing in the fact the family was growing bigger in size and numbers each year. He died at the age of 68. This year of 1978 will have been his 100th birthday, August 13, 1877 to August 13, 1977.